I want to talk to you today about a very simple subject that I think we all know and understand, and you've probably heard many, many countless times over, and we're going to go to that context in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and focus on the phrase, proclaim the Lord's death. And this is a very basic type of lesson, because you've heard this before. And I sometimes will tell people the motivation and the reason why I pick certain subjects. And today is going to be one of those days. You'd have to be under a rock to not realize or understand or feel the polarization in this country. And that polarization can create divisions amongst people across many, many different lines. And even after this election is finally settled down and over, that's going to continue on, because unfortunately that's what marks the culture of this country, is polarization. And we've already spent a great deal of time this morning talking about this, so it's really just an extension now of some things that we've already covered, looking at just Jesus' own disciples, about what brought them together was the fact of who Jesus was, what message he came to deliver, and then the means by which he fulfilled it, by being crucified on a cross. And that is the ultimate, ultimate unifying force and message amongst any people on that walks upon this earth. Because it doesn't matter what your heritage is, it doesn't matter whatever it is that you grew up with, whatever wrongs that you've endured, whatever rights that you've had, it just doesn't matter because of one basic thing. We go through this life, we live under the sun, and we die under the sun, as we've seen and learned from the Ecclesiastes writer. And in evaluating life and experiencing all those things, he summed it all up. This is the totality of all things: fear God and keep his commandments. And if you notice, it's that simple and compact, and there are no provisos, there are no qualifications about who should do that. That's for everybody, because we all live under the sun, and we all face the same problem, which is someday we're going to die. And when we're dead, and our spirit is all that remains, what happens next? Because there is a struggle that happens in this existence between right and wrong and truth and deception that rages even to this day, even though the battle's already over and the victory's already won, doesn't mean that the skirmishes and the fights have stopped. They still continue. And so the thing that I want you to focus on is, what are we given by virtue of Jesus' life and being his disciples? And fundamentally, what we've been given is this proclamation that, as simple as it may look on the outside, by virtue of what we assemble to do, by partaking of some bread, by drinking of some fruit of the vine, in remembrance of him, it looks like the most simple and mundane practices in all existence. That it has immense ramifications and power that's afforded to it. Now, in normal life settings, proclamations and this kind of power is only reserved for the elite, for those at the top, those with the privilege and power to be able to enjoy it. And the thing I want us to understand and concentrate on is that what Jesus has given us, with all of his preeminence and power and everything else that's due to him, he has chosen to share that with us equally by virtue of what we come to do on the first day of the week. And I'll go through some context to help amplify and bear that out. And so here in the United States, where anybody can get on social media, anybody can put out a tweet or get onto Instagram or whatever else, the power of a proclamation feels a bit lost. It's watered down because anybody feels like they can say anything. But there's only a few very, very limited things in life that have a proclamation with power that is associated with it. And we have been given a proclamation of power, of force, of might, that this world has never seen before and never will till the end of time with respect to its outcome. So what is a proclamation? It's an ability to announce officially or publicly, declare something one considers important with due emphasis, demonstrate or indicate clearly, literally, to shout forth. The power to proclaim is a rare privilege among men. Rare. Sometimes it's granted to a select few. If you happen to be a person of the court pre 1500s, and a king would make a proclamation and the guy would take it, and he'd be the town crier, and he'd go out and he'd read it. He had the power of proclamation. That one guy and that one guy alone. Do you realize, and this is the point of my emphasis today, that we have been given the greatest proclamation known to mankind by our King? And what are you going to do with it? We do one thing with respect to meeting together to proclaim the Lord's death until He comes. Do you understand the power that's behind that? Do you understand the need to continue to shout that forth every day of our lives? However, whenever, in whatever setting and circumstance we can find, independent and separate apart from what we do together as brethren to partake of this Lord's Supper that He's given to us today. So I really want you to understand what's the power of this proclamation. Because in a generation and world that we live in, this world needs this proclamation now as much as any time or ever in our lifetimes. And that's not to declare this is better or a worse time than something else. But the persistent fact that this world needs this proclamation. Needs this proclamation. And there are those that desperately want and need to find it. As is said in Mark the 16th chapter, beginning in verse 14, afterward He appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at table, and He rebuked them for their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they had not believed those who saw Him after He had risen. And He said to them, go into all the world and proclaim the gospel to the whole creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. And that same command exists for us to this very day, unchanged, unwavering in its forcefulness and commitment that we must give to it as His disciples. But now let's look at a few things. And I already referenced that context in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. But to read it again in full, for I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus on the night when He was betrayed took bread, and when He had given thanks, He broke it and said, this is My body which is for you. Do this in remembrance of Me. In the same way also He took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in My blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of Me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes. Now let's dig this apart and let's see what's in it. So what is it that we are proclaiming? Two very basic things. This is My body which is for you. This is My body which is for you. And we're going to really pull that some more apart and really hopefully give some other context that can expand on that and deepen that understanding for us. Because of what it means for both Jesus to have a body and the need of giving it for us so that we can have a benefit from it. The second is, this cup is the new covenant in My blood. And there's two parts to this one, just the same. What is the new covenant? And do we understand and appreciate all the benefits and privileges and blessings afforded to us by it? And what does it mean to create that covenant in His blood? And remember, Jesus didn't experience just a pinprick and be able to put it on a piece of parchment and say, that's the securing of the covenant. No, He bled and died on a cross in full commitment towards establishing that new covenant in His blood. And what does that mean? And we'll look at that some more as well. But what we are proclaiming is the effectiveness and power behind Jesus' body and Jesus' blood, and what it means of what he's done for us in the new covenant that he's created. So let's look at a few things. First, starting with his body. John chapter 1, beginning in verse 14, says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." Do you recognize that in all of the different kinds of ways that man creates religion and other things like that, the idea of a creator coming down to his creation, in the form of his creation, is something that's unique to Christianity? And what it means for the creator to partake together with his creation in a way that means that he has come to us. That's what John is telling us here. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son, from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." And that came to us because the Word became flesh. 1 John chapter 4. "In this the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins." And he could only do that by becoming flesh and having a body and to be and experience life like us and as one of us. Amplifying on that idea further, Hebrews chapter 2, a familiar context there in describing this body and its purpose and benefits and what does it mean for us as we consider that Jesus himself also had a body. The Hebrew writer says this, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood," that's you and me, we live a life of flesh and blood, "he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted." And so here it bears out the fact of a few things. Number one, there cannot be death without a body. And that by virtue of Jesus' death, he's able to achieve victory and salvation in the defeat of death itself. Think about that. The way that you beat death is by killing death. And Jesus did that. But he had to have a body to do that. And so he partook of those things in order to destroy the one who has the power of death, the devil. But then the other part of this is, in explaining to us, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect. And life Jesus didn't go through life on a cakewalk journey. He went through it in the harshest of circumstances, having nothing. He commented once about how the birds of heaven have nests, but the Savior of the world, talking of himself, does not even have a place to rest his own head. Jesus had nothing. And he suffered the most humiliating death, not even justified, but unjustified. And he did that in order to partake of things and be made like his brothers in every respect. And the reason why is so that he could offer help to us. See, this is one of those things about people as we interact with them. Do you believe that somebody has greater understanding because of shared experience? And the answer is emphatically yes. Whether you come in and tell me something academically versus I know you experience the exact same thing that I do has an entirely different impact in level of understanding in our minds. That's just who we are. And so the fact that Jesus went through life, had a body, suffered, died, and was raised the third day is something immensely relatable to by all of us. Because we walk this life and have those same things. Those same problems, the same journey, the same outcome of death in the end. And knowing that Jesus experienced it all with us is our help, our aid in times when we need it, to know that we too can endure and see things through to the end. Over in Hebrews, the 9th chapter, beginning in verse 11, and this is actually a very long context that elaborates on the effectiveness and the power of Jesus' blood. So we're going to look at three different sections here. We'll start first, though, with this one beginning in verse 11. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, and he's talking about a contrast now between the earthly tabernacle that Moses was given as a blueprint by God versus the contrast of the things that are in heaven. So there's this great contrast that's happening about what happened under the old law and what did it really mean spiritually now that Jesus has been fulfilled and what is he doing in heaven? And he's going to go through and amplify and draw this comparison consistently through this context. So he's commenting here, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places. Mind you, then that means there's this holy place up in heaven above that is a representation, a copy of what we've been given as a physical representation in through the old law and through what Moses granted for us. Not by means of the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but by means of his own blood. And we've been studying in the Old Testament, so hopefully you've been reminded about this through our study of that on Wednesday evenings, about the great and immense amount of sacrifice that had to take place. And the privilege and the fact that that entry into the most holy of places was secured for only a very select few, the high priest, and for very rare occasions. But now he's talking about how does Jesus enter that same place in heaven above? By saying, not by means of blood and goats and calves, but by means of his own blood. So the purpose of Jesus having flesh and blood then is to have blood to offer to be able to enter into this holy place. Thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. And that's just purpose number one as it relates to his blood. We've got more. Going into verse 15, therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant, important, impactful thing number one, for where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. We've already established one reason why a death was necessary in the beginning, to crush the one who had the power of death, the devil. Now we've got the second. So it's a death is necessary in order for the new covenant to have effect, to have force, to be able to be revealed for us. For where there is a will involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood, for when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you. And in the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. So it was necessary to shed his blood because that's our only path and avenue for forgiveness. It's what he said here very clearly for it to be able to take place. Going further, thus it was necessary for the copies of the things to be purified with these rites. But the heavenly things themselves, with better sacrifices than these, So we understand and can relate to the fact that the old law had some pretty powerful and impactful things that were afforded to them. But now he's saying, no, there's something even better that comes from this Jesus who offers his blood. For Christ has entered, not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy places every year with blood not his own. For then he would have had to suffer repeatedly, he meaning Jesus, since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. That phrase, once for all, has enormous impact to it. Because what it means is, once for all, before, during, after, and forever. Once for all, at the end of ages, to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. That's what we've been given to proclaim. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. So how long are we proclaiming this? How long, you might ask? One time? Once a year? Once a month? Once only on special occasions or times? And this is the thing that I think that is most misunderstood in trying to parse that question, is that what he tells us is two things that I've highlighted now in this phrasing. For as often, number one, often, not infrequently, often, often doesn't have a count to it, just like us giving our best doesn't have a bar. Often means often. Should we be trying to parse that to figure out how often is not often? Think about that. That makes no sense. So as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. It's the only point in which the proclamation doesn't matter anymore. Is the fact that when he comes, the proclamation won't be necessary because all this existence has passed away. That means final judgment has been rendered and the proclamation fulfilled. And so as you think about this, as you put this into your practice of your life, please understand those things. That the frequency should not be attempted to be parsed. We're given to this to do upon the first day of the week as often as we do. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup. And we do it until he comes again. And we should finally see it as a privilege and a ability to proclaim the Lord's death, a unique privilege in all of our existence of these things. Because it is all about Jesus. As the Messiah, the Son of Man, God in the flesh, the great Deliverer, and our Redeemer. And so why wouldn't we want to come together and proclaim that on the first day of every week? Why wouldn't we? And so I would reverse the question if anybody ever asks this, well, how often do I have to? By saying, why wouldn't you? You've been given the most unique and gifted power known to mankind, which is proclaim the Lord's death until he comes, and all the privileges and benefits and salvation that's afforded for that. So why wouldn't you want to come and do that? And let me comment here for just a moment. Being able to do this together is vitally important. Vitally important. We were not meant as Christians, we've talked about this already before, we were not meant as Christians to participate and to practice as if Christianity can be implemented as a one-person sport. That's not who we are. We've studied this already in Hebrews, the 12th chapter. We're individuals of one another. Yes, I have to be accountable for myself, but I am just as important an integral part of you as you are of me. And so doing this together is vitally important. Vitally important. And the other reason why I've chosen to give you this subject today and to look at it for that reason is this. And for brethren that are here, or for anybody that's looking at this as a recording, or still separated and apart from us because of things that are related to this virus, brethren, you are losing out on something by not being here with us. I am losing out on something by you not being here with me. And I say that not as a criticism, but as a point of consequence. That the longer that we go in partaking of this fruit of the vine in this cup apart, it will have a consequence. It has a consequence with respect to how I am connected to you, and you are connected to me. And so my ability to be individuals in one of another is impaired by the ability to not do this together. And I say that, therefore, for as a point of awareness, for thought, for contemplation, then to understand and do and commit ourselves to doing this together. It is vitally important. It is a privilege. It is an honor. And it is important for each and every one of us to do together. So as we think about this today, let us proclaim this day and every time we partake the awesome and mighty power, wisdom, and glory that is found in through Jesus and his death on a cross, and the privilege and power that comes and is granted to us by declaring that message.